WBAI on the air.
Happy.
Hello.
I don't hear you on the air.
Say that again. I'm sorry.
Oh, now I hear you. Now.
Oh.
I just heard you.
Oh, you're back, Monroe. But
I didn't mention I'm a 50-year member of WBAI.
Oh, great.
I didn't hear you on the air. That's the only reason I called back.
Good.
And now you're back on.
Yeah.
Okay, carry on.
We were doing something, and anyway, thank you very much. Bye bye. And let me say that you have been listening to Labrish. Stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf with Jim Prine. That comes up like right after this. And you've been listening to Labrish. My name is Haptah Selassie. We'll be back next week with another edition of the program. Labrish is produced by Ian Forrest with assistance from Seduzo Kambili, and is a De Jazzmack production. Remember to tell the people whom you love that you love them and show affection. With love, we'll find unity and strength. One love. Walk good. Mr. Touch.
Got to build our love on one foundation. Be, yeah, no love at all. There will never be no love at all. I've got to put aside name segregation. I've got to put aside name organization. I've got to put aside. There will never be no love at all. I mean, there will never be no love at all. So build our love on one foundation. Come, let us build our love on one solid foundation. Got to build our love. We are birds of a feather. We got to come together, 'cause we are birds of a feather. We got to come together, 'cause we are birds of a feather. Or there will never be, Lord of mercy, no love at all. There will never be, yeah, yeah, at all. We also got to realize we are one people. Yeah, got to realize that we are one people. Yeah, we got to realize we are one people. Or there will never be no love at all.
Lupus interruptus. Let's try that again. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Saturday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination, and occasionally Time Lords. My name is Jim Freund. This is going to be a wonderful but initially confused show because we are gathering a slew of people. Editors, writers, people, well, chicks who dig Time Lords. Stay tuned.
Consented, all parties were agreed. Her portion 30 shillings.
Okay. There's the sound effect. That probably doesn't mean a lot to a lot of the people here right now, because that's the TARDIS sound effect from approximately 1968. The TARDIS landing. Let me make sure. Lynn, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, good, good. Yes, I can hear you, and we'll get to you in just a moment. But I wanted to make sure that I had you on the air before I progressed, because technologically speaking, I'm... but you're there, and I'm going to start talking to you first. We have people gathering in this room one by one. Tempest is already here, but we have to tell the listeners what we are doing, and I get to hold court first because it's my show. So your mic is live and you're on. Okay.
Okay.
And you were able to hear the music through the phone and everything.
Yes. Yes, I was.
Great. Okay. So we are going to start with a little of my personal history, okay, because it's my show, as I said. Hi, Kat.
Hi.
I haven't seen you in months.
I know.
Last time was aboard ship, I think.
Well, good grief, it was.
Yeah. you know we were thrown out of the seaport?
What?
Yeah, we're no longer there.
I'll
have to say what? No, it's, well, no. No, it isn't. And if it was, so be it. But then you know what happened after, but you know why? I'm not bitter and I'm not sore about it, because half of the reason that I loved the seaport was because we all went to Ryan McGuire's Ale House afterward, and it has burned to the ground. It no longer exists. It is a cinder. It will not be back for at least 3 years. So that takes away some of the bitter pill of... I'm sorry, Russell Tovey has entered the room. No, not the Russell Tovey who's on, you know, who's on board the starship running the ship. The Russell Tovey who's a werewolf, at any rate. At any rate, okay, my story, okay. First of all, I have to complain bitterly. I have to complain bitterly about new horrid draconian rules that have taken over here at WBAI. No, I'm not joking. And it's not WBAI's fault. It is not Pacifica's fault. It is the fault of DMCA. That is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. I expect all tech magazines, including Laptop, to be complaining about this. But I'll start with Computer World. But at any rate, Tempest knows what I'm talking about. It's all in. But see, what's going on is we have to log talking, music, everything, real time. I'm supposed to be typing in at the same time I am doing this show, got a person on the phone, engineering everybody here, and I am not capable of doing this at this moment, so I'm breaking federal law at this moment.
Awesome.
Grr. It means, by the way, that I mean, the way that we're going to have to settle this is I need an intern, okay? It's the only way it can happen. So actually, I'll take applications online. Jim@ourwolf.com. That's HOURWOLF. I'm serious. There's no way I can bleeping. Okay. So that's the bitching done for this morning. I don't have a guest next week, so expect to hear a lot more. Somewhere in the mid-1970s, I've been doing the show a long time. This show's been on the air since 1972, and I took it over in 1974, being the newbie. And I guess it was, probably about 1976, that after I did an episode of the show, I went home. It was a Saturday morning, Channel 9, which is just, you know, WOR, just some local channel. Ran some, you know, various bad kids shows. And I turned one on, and it was episode 3 of something called Robot. Yeah. And, you know, this was like a guy in a scarf doing stuff that really related more to Harpo Marx than anything else. And I'm coming in on episode 3 of the first series, and this guy talks about, well, you weren't like that when you were somebody else. This woman, Sarah Jane, who's some kind of companion or something with him, she can't quite get over the fact that he's now this furry guy, where apparently he used to be an older guy. And I'm going, what in God's name is this thing? They ran two episodes. They finished off Robot. I'm not even coming in on the beginning, so I didn't see what we now know was the regeneration. I'm sorry, I'm laughing because somebody put in a hideous green on the air light in this room that wasn't there before, and somebody's put a glove over it, and it looks hilarious. It's just wonderful. I'm going to tweet this at some point, but so you can all see how ridiculous this is. But at any rate,
you know, swearing count as your documentation?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So that was my, but it was weird and bizarre, and some people may have been sort of like, yeah, no, this is not me. I can't get into it. But I was, I had a chemically altered mind, and I enjoyed it. I just thought that this was the weirdest and coolest thing I had ever seen. And as I continue watching and start watching credits, I'm a big credit watcher, this fellow, this radio writer, became the editor, what, about in the fourth year of the Tom Baker years. It had moved from Channel 9 to Channel 21, one of the smaller local PBS station here. And this guy was a guy who was writing a radio series. Now, you know, when somebody comes up with a major radio series, science fiction comedy radio series called The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, I'm all ears. I'm there. And he was all, but that was his night job, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. His day job was he was the story editor of Doctor Who. And he came to the U.S. and was doing the rounds of Pacifica stations, this fellow named Douglas Adams. And he was in touch with our station manager who said, oh, sci-fi, you talk to Jim. You know, the 5 a.m. show. So I had Douglas Adams on. Yeah. And now this story can be told. He had these BBC transcription discs. Now, WBAI always ran the Goon Show. We were the purveyors of things goonish in those days. And so he gave us these discs so we can broadcast these proprietary transcription discs. And so on this show, we began running The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy 3 years before NPR did. Utterly, completely, illegally. But, you know, who was the pirate? People wanted to know. BBC wanted to know. The pirate, I will now say, was Douglas Adams. Go after him.
Get him now, BBC.
Yeah, really, really. Try.
Hey, good luck with that.
Yeah, thanks. I see on Wikipedia somebody claims that Mike O'Dell on Hour 25 in L.A. broadcast Hitchhikers first. Not true. Michael, a wonderful person, when I was the host of when I was Margo Adler's co-host on Hour of the Wolf, Thursday and Friday, Michael was co-hosted with occasionally Neil Conan, who's the executive producer of All Things Considered and producer what Talk of the Nation?
I think so.
On some other radio
network.
That network. Well, he's nation. He's national.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
He and Adler are national. Yeah, they're slumming over there.
They're fancy people.
Yeah, exactly.
And do they have a glove covering their on-air sign?
I bet not.
No, they don't. They don't.
I've been over there. They don't have anything that's cool.
No, have you been on NPR or have you been on NYC?
NPR.
Oh, you have? Okay. Yeah. Oh, that's wait, that show that you were on, Tempest.
That was News and Notes.
Right. I thought that was an NYC show.
Mm-mm.
That was an NPR show.
It was a West Coast show, and so they sent me over to the NPR station instead of WNYC. It's very convoluted.
So of course, when they started, you know, cutting back, the first thing they did was get rid of the multicultural program. But anyway,
it's true.
Did I say that? No. I wouldn't say that. I would never say that. At any rate. Where was I? We have to get back to the doctor, don't we? So anyway, and Time Lords, okay? So that was the Douglas Adams story. So I met the story editor of Doctor Who, you know, and it's like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was the greatest radio drama ever created, in my humble opinion. I just love the first series. I just love that, especially like the first four episodes. And the books, for those people who think that this is a book, yeah, became a book 3 years later. Okay? It was a radio drama, for those who don't know. Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was radio first. Oh, and yeah, Mike Hodel did broadcast it about a week after we did, because I know that because Douglas told me that he was going here, then he was going to our L.A. station, which is where Michael was, and then he went to our San Francisco station, and all where Richard Lupoff was doing a science fiction program. We had three science fiction shows in the country, all Pacifica Radio, and all done by wonderful people. Mike is unfortunately, he died at about age 49 or something. His body just, well, sort of like Terry Carr, his body just wasn't made to last for many years. His show still exists as a webcast. Somebody else does Mike Hodel's Hour 25. It was Ellison, Harlan Ellison, a good close friend of Tempest.
He and
my close friend, and yes, he is a good friend, Norman Spinrad. We'll discuss that off the air. But Norman... Okay, anyway. That's all I'm going to say on that topic. We'll talk, Norman. He means well. He does, really, Tempest. He does. He means well. The rest?
No comment.
I know. Anyway, getting back. This is so, and I know a lot of listeners don't know what we're talking about. Google Norman Spinrad and Tempest Bradford, or people like that. Is there somebody else you would recommend?
If you Google Norman Spinrad Asimov's,
there you go. You'll get to read the article
that we're talking about.
And you can make your own decision, as long as it's the right one. So, to me, that was Doctor Who. I was a huge Tom Baker fan, and when some guy came on, good actor, but he wore a celery stick, it wasn't quite the same, okay? Then it became Doran. I watched a little, I couldn't get into Colin Baker. I thought it was too rough, too dark, but I did like Sylvester McCoy because there was some wordplay back, and I was just getting into the show again when canceled. For no real good reason, by somebody in the House of Lords who didn't get the show, you know, basically, and was on the BBC Board of Governors, just killed it. Then there was a one-shot revival, which was Paul McGann was a good doctor, but the scriptwriter was not a good scriptwriter, and they introduced something into Doctor Who which had never been seen before. Snogging, which for American audiences means a kiss. And it was misplaced. It wasn't well conceived. It wasn't well thought out. And the idea of the companion and the story and the reintroduction of Eric Roberts, Julia Roberts' brother, as the master.
They just shouldn't let Eric out of the house. Ever.
And they shouldn't have a camera in that house. You know, you have to cover all bases
right.
Here, okay?
Just no camera time for Eric.
No, I'm afraid not. I mean, I don't have a problem with no piece of scenery unchewed. but it has to be done properly, okay? So, come, what, 2005?
Yeah.
Reboot. A writer by the name of Russell Davies, who I knew a little about because I had seen this fabulous, wonderful two-part show called The Second Coming.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, I love The Second Coming. I think it's available on DVD.
It is. It's commercially available.
Oh, good. Okay. Because I got it through other means. And and the guy who wrote that, some guy named Russell Davies, was creating this thing, and I was not ready, okay? I was not ready for a reboot. It's like I'm reading things like big money, special effects. Doctor Who is about zippers and strings on the moon, and, you know, his TARDIS
should be about 4 inches tall, you know, against a little, you know, snow globe backdrop. That's about the level of Doctor Who. That was the charm of the show, is how cheap and how just, you know, low rent the whole thing was. Well, it was incredibly good. Chris Eccleston is an amazing actor. And that rebirthed the whole series. The only major complaint, outside of one or two lesser scripts, but the only major complaint that I had was that Eccleston only did one season. I liked the first episode somewhat with the introduction of Rose Tyler, but I loved it with the second episode.
End of the World,
which, as far as I'm concerned, took place at the restaurant at the end of the universe. It really
so,
was.
So was Peter Davis in the dish of the day then?
Yeah, might as well have been. I mean, it really was a Douglas Adams homage. There were references, even the Tree Woman is something that comes out of Douglas Adams, and that's when I just, you know, went, oh my God, this is wonderful. By the way, personally, we'll try to avoid the B word. You cannot watch Doctor Who without hearing the word brilliant 30 times a minute, I swear. And if you ever watch Doctor Who Confidential, especially the British version of it, oh, he's brilliant, that's brilliant, this is brilliant. These people are so brilliant that they are brighter than light bulbs.
An even better drinking game is we're doing something that's never been done before.
pull the mic a little closer.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, you don't have to sit forward. Just pull the mic back so you're relaxed.
Thank you.
There you go. That's better.
Yeah, yes, we actually tried to clock that one time. Every time in the confidential, somebody said, you know, we're doing something that's never been done before. Well, what about last week's never been done before?
Yeah. Yes. But we're dealing with Time Lords. Right? So when they did it, they had never done it before. They went forward in time to do it for the first time, and then they went back, you see.
It's too early for that.
Wobbly, timey-wimey.
No, it's too late for that. You're the one who didn't do an all-nighter.
That's true.
Okay, and presume. Okay, so fast forward. As regular listeners to this show know, we do my sort of version of reality show, where a writers group called Altered Fluid comes in here, and they do what I think is one of the bravest things in the world. A writer comes on, reads the first draft of a story, and their writers group then criticizes that story. You know, criticizes it positively, negatively, but deals with that content. And it is wonderful radio, if I say so myself. I mean, I'm the platform, okay? I'm not the person doing it. And what we do, and what we're going to do in just a couple of moments, if I can shut up, is go around the room and ask everybody what they're doing. Like, you know, how many World Fantasy Awards do you have? Or, you know, something like that.
Don't point at me. I don't have any. You don't? Two nominations, zero wins.
Oh. Well, that'll change. You know.
It's
going to change. Everybody palimpsest. One word. Palimpsest. Anyway. Okay. So anyway. As we went around the room, that was me slapping me. That wasn't any of the women slapping me. That I've no doubt I'll give incentive. But anyway, the Tempest Bradford, Kay Tempest Bradford, has also been on this program in her own right as a writer, and whose story,
Until Forgiveness Comes,
we're going to produce as radio drama here, directed by Andrea Hairston. Yes. and we saw Andrea this week, so that was really gratifying. Mentioned that, I said, tell us where you're going to be, and she said, I'm in Chicks Dig Time Lords.
As they say on the internet.
Exactly. Right. Yes, that what you the sound, the woot that you just heard is the editor of said book, and I just said, I'm there. Okay, this means radio show an event, which the first part of which Tempest took into hand and occurred last night. And to give it space, we're going to do one. The way I figure it is Matt Smith, that's the 11th Doctor, Matt Smith will be premiering in England on Easter Day, and in the U.S., they're actually going to be only a few days apart on BBC America on April 17th. Shut up! That's my phone. I didn't silence it. It's a Murph. Everybody just heard it. This is a Moogle Murph, okay?
Oh, okay.
That's what this phone is. I know it just said something else, but it's a Murph. Anyway, at least I didn't have it in my breast pocket next to the microphone this time, which has happened more than once. Anyway, so I figure 13 weeks after the new Doctor premieres, we'll be able to do another event. But in the meantime, Tempest said something that I hadn't heard. She said, "Oh yeah, we've got a cover by from the people who did Torchwood Baby." Torchwood Babies. I'm not only there. I need to be there. And I went online and I googled up Torchwood Babies.
Oh no.
It is just bleeping wonderful. It is. That's my B word, okay? And after this program, immediately after this program, you all listening have to do the same. And then I saw the cover for Chicks Dig Time Lords, and I knew that I was on the right track. And Tempest and I arranged, I guess we arranged this particular weekend right then and there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. And on the phone, I will start with Lynn Thomas, who is one of the editors.
Yeah.
Tell us about Chicks Dig Time. Oh, but you know what I have to do? We have to create an ambiance. Okay, here we are. Very good.
Awesome.
Okay, now we are in the TARDIS. Now you can begin to... I have the complete BBC Radiophonic Workshop files here. I really do.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Hi, Lynn.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Tell us about this book.
Well, this is an anthology that was actually the brainchild of my co-editor, Tara O'Shea, who several years ago, for one of her first Doctor Who conventions after coming back into the fold, decided to make up a bunch of geeky T-shirts. And one of the T-shirts said, "Chicks Dig Time Lords." And I made grabby hands because I thought the T-shirt was awesome. She pitched the T-shirt title as the title of a book that would be about the female fandom experience in Doctor Who land to the Mad Norwegian Press, and started work on it because they took the pitch and they thought it was a great idea and what a great title. But then her life kind of imploded. There were some medical issues with her parents and things got a little crazy, and so I was brought into the project. And every time that you bring in new chefs, the soup changes a little bit. And so what ended up happening was that in addition to her original concept, which brought in fan writers to write about their experiences with the series, I brought in professional writers. In my day job, I'm an archivist who works with science fiction and fantasy literature at Northern Illinois University. So,
oh, cool.
I love my job.
you and I are going to have to talk because I've got 40 years of radio. I've got Anthony Boucher's tapes, okay?
Wow.
Yeah, so we have to talk because there's stuff here that needs archiving.
Okay, well, you've got my contact info. So
I do now, yes.
We can do that offline.
Yeah, yes.
but, yeah, so I'm in my day job, I'm a science fiction archivist, and as part of my day job, I do lots of other things, but that's a big part of it. And so what ended up happening was when we sat down and looked at the book, since I'm a librarian, I'm trained to think that there should be something in the library to offend absolutely everyone. That's how you know you're doing it right. and so Tara and I sat down when I was brought into the project and talked about the shape of the book and decided that bringing in, you know, professional writers, if we could get them, and we begged and pleaded and paid them a pittance, and they did it anyway, bless their hearts. If we could bring in professional writers who happen to be fans of the series, and if we could get a whole bunch of folks involved with the series, either the television series as produced proper, or people who were part of the ancillary products that happened during the years when the TV series was off the air, the audio plays, the novels, that would make a really well-rounded book and a really diverse book. And it ended up being this sort of big tent where the guiding principle is there's no right way to do this, but we all love it. And, you know, there are folks with whom I vehemently disagree in terms of what our favorite episodes are, who our favorite doctors are, and lots of other little things that, as fans, we spend an inordinate amount of time discussing animatedly. but on the other hand, we all love the series to bits. And what we wanted to do was to produce a book that celebrated the fact that we love this series to bits, and to do so in a way that focused on the female fan experience, because there hasn't been a lot out there like that. My husband is a Doctor Who collector. I actually married into fandom, and that's what my essay in the book is about. And he has a large nonfiction collection. That's what he does. That's part of his focus as a collector. And when you look around the shelves in his room, with the exception of Sophie Aldred's autobiography and a couple of other companion autobiographies that have come out in recent years, the books are almost to a title. They are all by men. There is not a lot of documentation, with the exception of Paul Cornell's License Denied, which has some essays by women Who fans. There is not a lot of documentation of the female fan experience in Doctor Who. So that's what we decided to do. And one of the things that we learned as we talked to contributors around the world, because we have contributors from three continents in the book, was that the fan experience was completely different depending on where you lived, and, you know, how the show was broadcast. So your story
And I'm willing to bet also your age, because yes, I came in the Tom Baker era, so that's my first Doctor.
Yeah, well, your story about coming in during the Tom Baker years is a very typical American fan story. In fact, we had several early versions of the essays when they came in their initial drafts. We had there were, I think, 28 contributors in the book, and I think about 15 of them, we had to go back and say, okay, everybody else also saw Tom Baker on their local PBS station, curly hair, scarf. Okay, we need to cut this and cut to the chase to the other part that's different. Not because we wanted to silence that, but because it gets repetitive when 15 people all come to the series in exactly the same way. So it's a very common experience, whereas, of course, in the U.K., your favorite doctor, your favorite companions, et cetera, typically depends upon your age, because it's a cultural icon in the U.K. in the way that it is a cult thing here. It's a very different experience to be part of the fandom there. And in the U.K., the view is that fandom is predominantly male. And in Australia, according to the statistics that Kate Orman pulled for her essay, the fandom is also predominantly male, but like 80% male.
I find that appalling, because my partner Barbara, so many women I know, mm-hmm. just thought that Tom Baker was, you know, the bee's knees.
Sure, and that's not unusual. A lot of women who came into Doctor Who fandom, and who especially in the United States were the driving force behind building a specific Doctor Who fandom as opposed to being part of general FF fandom, doing things like running conventions and writing fanzines and publishing, they came over a lot of the time from Star Trek fandom. So they already had sort of the machinations for how fandom could work, and they just transferred it to a different show. But that's unique to the U.S., as far as we can tell. Wow. Most of the fandom in the U.K., in the experience at least of the writers in this book, and in Australia and New Zealand, was almost 80% male.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a very, and it was, that was a surprise to us. But, you know, part of it is that Tara often talks about the story where she saw a lot of the media coming out of the UK about the relaunch of Doctor Who. And there seemed to be this concept that there were no women who were Doctor Who fans. And, you know, she's sitting here in the U.S. going, what do you mean we've been here all along?
I just wonder if there's a question of the women not being as vocal.
That's entirely plausible, and that's one of the things we wanted to talk about in the book. I mean, this is a book where what we wanted to do was to get a cross-section of experiences and a cross-section of ways that people express their fandom. And by doing that, to show the diversity of the fandom that it really is out there, so that, you know, when you meet a Doctor Who fan, they can hand you this, and they can say, this is what it's about for me. because there will be something in here that reflects their experience. Not everything, but something in there. And, you know, for men who are Doctor Who fans who have girlfriends or wives or sisters or daughters who are looking at them funny and saying, what is it about this show that appeals to you? This is something they can hand to them and say, here are some other women who really love the show in lots of different ways. See if you can find something that might resonate with you.
Or you can do the thing that's right and just write those guys off, you know.
Well, but the thing is, you shouldn't have to, you know. That's the nice thing.
Yeah, well, converting them is good, yeah.
Okay. Conversion is good. Obviously, I'm a convert. That makes me a zealot, you know. It's just the way of the world, you know. And I came into my fandom of the series during what we call the wilderness years, when the series wasn't on the air. So
yeah.
I had the benefit of not being restricted to what was being broadcast, because, you know, that was the 1990s when we had access to videos. And so what my husband did was he showed me a whole slew of different doctors to see what would click with me. And what ended up clicking with me personally was revelation, was Remembrance of the Daleks, Ace and a baseball bat and a Dalek. That was what did. But everybody has a different experience, and that's one of the things that we tried to show in the book. Okay, I think I'm done now.
Okay, well, that was a fabulous introduction and a good start. But before we continue, which we will do, it will be your job, Lynn, to every so often say the name of the book is Chicks Who Dig Time Lords from Mad Norwegian Press. Have you got that?
Okay, that's the name of the book is Chicks Dig Time Lords from Mad Norwegian Press.
Okay.
Available at fine booksellers everywhere, especially online.
Okay, set a timer and do that again in 10 minutes. Okay, let us now go around the room. Everybody, please introduce yourselves. Tell us a little bit about your Whovian experience and of course, who you are. So do who you are first and then how you relate to who you are. No.
My name is Debbie Stanish, and my essay in the book is called My Fandom Regenerates. And you know, it's kind of an interesting story how I got involved in the book. The Gallifrey convention that Tara was at, my editor of, I write for a fanzine called Enlightenment, which is the official fanzine of the Doctor Who Canadian fan club, even though I live in Philadelphia. and that particular issue was at Gallifrey One. I think it was called, there was an article that the editor Graham Burke and I did together called He Said, She Said, which he queried me about girl fandom, and I responded and asked him questions about boy fandom. And it was really kind of a very interesting back and forth. It was genuinely interested in our different perspectives. And I think, and Graham has worked with Lars Pearson and Mad Norwegian Press, and they said, you know, this is the kind of essay that we think would be interesting. And Tara had my editor contacted me and says, there's this rumbling about this book, and I think they might be interested in this essay, which I ended up not using that. And I was asked to contribute something personally. And basically, my experience was I was not involved in Who fandom at all. I bumped into Tom Baker when I was younger, and not physically, but on PBS.
And I was about to go, ooh.
I did that personally. Yeah. Go ahead.
And I thought it was the strangest thing I'd ever seen and just kind of kept going. I didn't pause the dial for very long after I saw, you know, Bubble Wrap Monsters. But I was involved in other fandoms, and all of a sudden, people that I trusted and I knew in fandom.
You know what's sick is when you said Bubble Wrap Monsters, I know you're talking about Colony of Mars.
That's Colony of Mars. Yeah.
Because I went back after I really got into Doctor Who. I said, what was that episode that really turned me off?
We in radio drama are
very. And I was thinking Ark in Space.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I stand corrected, Lynn. Thank you. It's Ark in Space.
Was
with
it
the
Ark
green
Space?
With the green bubble wrap.
Yes. It was Ark in Space.
Yes, and because we in radio drama are very big on bubble wrap. the large bubbles, not the little guys. They don't count. Okay.
So, you know, I was basically dragged into it kicking and screaming by people that I trusted and people that whose opinions that I really respected were saying, no, this is really incredible. It's really awesome. And I started watching in June of 2005, by means which we will no longer talk about. And, you know, the first episode was interesting. The second episode was good. The third episode, and it just, I got to the point where it was 3 o'clock in the morning and I needed to see the next episode. And
yeah.
I knew at that point that, okay, this is for me. So it's, I, from that point on, I was obviously a fan of the current series, and I made the mistake of thinking that Doctor Who was a very linear thing, which is just madness. So I decided that, well, the ninth, let's go back and let's talk about the eighth Doctor, and what's going on with the eighth Doctor, and how did we get to the ninth Doctor? And I watched the TV movie and laughed a lot. but then I fell into the world of the Eighth Doctor adventures, the books, the BBC books, and the Big Finish audios, which are fabulous, except for Minuet in Hell, which is absolutely dreadful and horrible accents. And from there, you know, it's kind of interesting for me that Doctor Who fandom started out as a very current and something that was immediate and that people were talking about and buzzing about, and this was something that was happening now. But it really acted as a gateway for me to go back and explore this really dense backstory of Doctor Who. And Tom Baker is still not my favorite Doctor. you know, okay. I'm more of a seven and three kind of girl.
You've got years to live and you will change.
That's what people keep telling me, but I think you either get four or you don't get four. And
it's true. It's true.
And
yeah.
he wasn't the Doctor that clicked.
Who is? You know, I know who it'll be.
You know, nine is the Doctor of my heart because he was my first. But, you know, I really, really enjoy Sylvester McCoy. I really like seven.
Cool.
And I really like the third Doctor.
You're the first person I know who's really a Sylvester McCoy.
You know,
I liked him a lot, but, you know.
Now, he's really dark and kind of twisted and really controlling, and I like that. we won't discuss what that means about me, but, you know, I really like the fact that he is... he plays with people a little bit, and you really get that sense.
I thought he was a very Tom Stoppard Doctor.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean by that, you know, wordplay and
very articulate, and you stand there, and he's completely talk circles around you until you're doing exactly what he wants you to do anyway. And I found that very fascinating.
Yeah. Okay. Miss Bradford.
Hey. So as Jim mentioned,
who is basically, by the way, I should say, the producer of this morning's show, because she has gotten these amazing people and Lynn and everybody together and made this all happen, as she did the reading last night at Blue Stockings, which you can get into a TARDIS and attend, or and I'm sorry I couldn't. I am still getting over illness, which will sadly keep me away from LunaCon. I just can't do it.
Wow.
And now Barbara's full fledged. So,
oh no!
Oh yeah! Oh yeah!
No.
So well, we pass it back and forth.
Such is the way of things.
So I'm really sorry that I missed that last night, but we're going to do another.
Yes. Well, we did have a lot of fun last night. We were at Blue Stockings and lots of people came.
A wonderful bookstore. Go
wonderful
anytime.
Bookstore. Oh, definitely. And they were so kind to just let us have, you know, the space for free, and we just had a really good time. So, as Jim mentioned, my name is Kay Tempest Bradford, and this all got started because I was on his show, and I'm like, I'm in this book. I can't remember what the name of the book is, but I'm in this book, because I was really high on 5-Hour Energy at the time. But it's a long story.
Yeah, but it was so infectious. I mean, I just said, yes, I'm there.
Yeah, and so the way I got my essay in the book is called Martha Jones Fangirl Blues, and it is about my love of Martha Jones as a companion, and how I am annoyed that people assume that I love Martha Jones because she's a black lady and I'm a black lady. That's not the reason I love her, but it's very hard to love Martha considering like what the writers do to her all the time, and how
they eventually married her off.
Which, oh God. So I try not to think about that.
But human nature, you want to become a, let me tell listeners, you want to become a Martha Jones fan, watch the two episodes.
Well,
Human Nature.
I don't know, because maybe it might make you a Martha Jones fan, but as a person who loves Martha deeply, Human Nature is a really hard episode for me to watch, that those two, Human Nature and Family of Blood, because I feel like so much racial and sex, like gender, there's just like a lot of bad undercurrent going on there.
Which is actually one of the reasons I liked it, because I thought it was supposed to be a comment, and that
I'm not entirely sure that it was supposed to be a comment, which is my problem with it, is I feel like there was a lot of not necessarily intentional racism and sexism going on, but a lot of
society.
What they thought that they were doing a good thing. Paul yeah. Cornell and Russell T. Davies and Phil, they all thought that they were doing something really awesome, and instead they were making Mark.
Well, I might be blind to that, so maybe but that's
basically what my essay is about. Like, I talk about human nature, and I talk about some of the other episodes from Series 3 that just made like my heart break, because you know I love Martha so much. I think that she's really awesome, and I feel like a lot of badness happened mm-hmm. to her, like, throughout that series that just was so unnecessary.
See, I'm a diehard, and I'm still with Sarah Jane.
Oh, well, there you go.
Including the new Sarah Jane adventures through series three,
yeah.
which have been really good and really emulate old Who.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a Sarah Jane guy.
I haven't had a chance to really get into Sarah Jane adventures yet, but I feel that I will have to, because I have not yet watched the episode where David Tennant shows up to her wedding.
So, spoiler!
Oh, I'm sorry. Didn't that like air like 12 years ago?
not in this country.
Oh, if you say so.
But not legally anyway. Say what, Lynn?
I said not legally anyway.
Oh, there we go.
Well, it didn't air in this country. It may have been seen,
but not aired.
In general, etiquette, casting is not spoilers.
Yeah, there we go. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah, and
that's a wonderful moment in that episode.
So
it really is.
I still have to watch
despite
that.
Despite Canine.
Despite Canine. Well, poor Canine. But the way that I got into Doctor Who, I am a new Who fan. I'm one of the people who old Who fans are always complaining about on the internet. Because the very first episode of Doctor Who I ever watched was Rose, which is the very first episode of the new series. And I think it's because I'm not sure that Doctor Who was on my PBS when I was a kid. And so I never remember encountering anything that looked anything like that. And I have seen some old episodes, like a few select ones. I'm like, yeah, I never saw that. So I was actually living at the time with a dear friend of mine named Scott McPartland, who was one of my professors at NYU. And he was one of the people who got me really interested in mythology and story and just like all the things that eventually made me into a writer. And so When they aired Rose on the Sci-Fi Channel.
You haven't done any autobiography yet, so I just have to say, you're a damned good writer, but go on.
Thank you. So when they aired Doctor Who on the Sci-Fi Channel, it was months and months and months after it had already like gone off in England. And so he knew, I sort of like vaguely knew that like some show had come back that everybody was excited about. I was like, okay, whatever, people. But Scott had been a Doctor Who fan since back in the day, so he was very excited. And so I sat down to watch this show with him, and I remember when the theme music came on, he said something like, I've been waiting more than 15 years to like hear this theme song again to an episode I've never seen. I was like, yeah. Oh.
And, so, with strings.
Yeah, and with strings. So I watched this episode with him, and I loved it. And the more, you know, it came on, the more I totally got into it, to the point where we were, like, in the middle of the season of the Sci-Fi Channel's, you know, showing of the season, and I acquired the rest of the episodes ahead of it because I was like, I can't wait to find out what's happening. So,
I must say, Doctor Who is well seen. I'd say even best seen in marathon sessions.
Yes, I agree. And that was my introduction to Doctor Who, and I completely fell into it. You know, Scott and I still like have these long conversations about the nature of the Doctor, and I wrote this essay that was on Fantasy Magazine a couple of years ago called title was The Lonely God is a Jerk, where I have my whole thesis about how I think that the Doctor is like a humongous...
Fantasy Magazine, available at fantasymagazine.org, edited by Kat Rambo, but
right.
Let's just move on, shall
but I wrote this...
We have to support small
presses. We have to support the little guys. But I wrote this essay because I saw that the Doctor was sort of like a complex, you know, he wasn't just some like real jerk. There was like some complexity going on there. And a lot of it was based on things that Scott had told me about the nature of the Doctor, and he was telling me about old episodes where, you know, the Doctor would do something like really horrible to someone, he would say something really horrible to someone, and they'd be like, how can you do that? Don't you have any feelings? And he would look at them, and he'd be like, I am an alien. Yeah, and that was just the whole thing. Like, he had a different, completely different, like, just conception of, you know, interaction, of what right and wrong because he's like this alien creature. And so I found that to be very fascinating. And I always keep that in mind whenever I watch Doctor Who now, because I can see them sort of doing that in the new series too. But I think that they were better at it in the old series. So
mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think in the new series.
This is a chance to chime in with the 10 minutes and say, we're talking about Chick Stink Time Lords, published by Fantastic Press. Available at fine booksellers everywhere.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Okay, so reset the timer. Okay, so as I said, this is a small press book, gang. And so, you know, if somebody comes on and says, available now from Random House, that's fine. You know, we'll promote the writer and all that. But we don't have to say, you know, who the press is or something like that. But when we're dealing with small presses or fantasy magazine or whatever, it's, you know, we have to give all the information out because these places need support, especially in these economic times. I was going to say something. Oh, yeah, one of the things that I love is that concept of alien. And just thrown away. The Doctor, from William Hartnell, was not a nice man, necessarily. He wasn't he wasn't benevolent and all that. There was some of that in Chris Eccleston. He really did that. But with David Tennant, I think they lost it. And I think what has been going on, this is my suspicion, because I watch a lot of Beeb shows, including, especially the ones for kids, like their version of Robin Hood, that reboot. Oh, cat.
Oh, my God. She's making a face.
Oh, okay. Robin, can you people see that look on the radio? Oh, you ought to be able to. It is that fierce a face. It had in its first couple of seasons merit.
That show.
Pull that mic closer to you.
That show finally made me realize that I actually don't even like the story of Robin Hood at all. I was watching it, and I mean,
Russell Crowe's very disappointed to hear.
Well, that. I'm sure that he'll cry himself to sleep tonight about it.
But, oh yeah, all the way to the
bank. But I'm watching that terrible, terrible show where they're just not even bringing up the whole Norman and Saxon issue, and people are just being jerks for no reason whatsoever.
But
I'm going, I actually don't even care about this story at all, and I'm never watching another Robin Hood.
But this is actually
again,
sort of my
point. That's how bad that show
and,
is.
And okay, so dare I say the M word? How do you feel about Merlin?
The one with Sam Neill?
We're Why talking no? about the BBC Kids series that has.
Oh, I haven't seen it.
Ah, well,
but you didn't like
Robin Hood. Get ready for a new low.
I have this philosophy. These, as we were walking to the station, we saw a sign for Clash of the Titans, and I shared my philosophy about these things, which are remakes of things that I cared about at some point. Not so much the original Clash of the Titans.
Although
movie,
I have to say, I tried to rewatch the Clash of the Titans last week. The first one.
I don't care about the original
movie.
And
I had to stop watching it so I could continue to like it.
But I can't go see movies about Greek mythology. And I can't go see movies about Arthuriana. And I will never see the new Alice in Wonderland movie because I can be angry at home for free. And I can tell from a preview that something's just going to anger me, I don't go. It's a revolutionary concept.
You know what? I share that. And people are always trying to get me to go to bad movies. They're like, but it'll be fun because we'll be fun. I'm like, I'm not giving somebody $9 so I can be angry.
Yeah.
More like 12.
Or
$12. You're already angry.
Exactly.
Name of your blog, for God's sake.
Yeah. Look, I don't need extra incentive and have paid money to then be more angry.
So anyhow, my belief, my opinion about all of this, including the Merlin, the Robin Hood, and the Doctor Who, bearing in mind, is supposed to be for 8-year-olds to hide behind the couch. That is
totally untrue. That is what writers hide behind when people criticize the new stories.
Right.
I think it hasn't been for children for a long, long time.
I agree.
And it was always designed as a family show, which meant it was aimed at very intelligent 12-year-olds, and that goes back to the Bob Holmes era.
Yeah,
think that the show we're watching now is remotely aimed at children, and the only time anybody says that is when someone says, wow, that was really terrible.
Okay, mm-hmm. Often. But you see, I agree with you when you say they hide behind that, but what they are doing, what the BBC is doing, is make sure that everything is a certain, and Sarah Jane Adventures falls into this as well, it's a certain kind, a certain brand of after school special, a certain kind of multicultural thing. And this is why I think the David Tennant ones lost that alien weirdness. He had to be nicer. Mm-hmm. He had to be more human, a policeman from the stars. As
but then he did such terrible things to people all the time.
Well,
he trapped a little girl in a mirror, for crying out. He's yes. not a nice person.
He's not actually, a nice guy.
We watched the Shakespeare Code this morning while we were waiting to come down here. And I noticed that
not their best moment.
Oh, no, not at all. Tempest likes it, though.
I love that
episode.
We had
a whole conversation.
I love that episode.
See, I'm sorry. Two Harry Potter jokes? No. Absolutely not. But so at the end of that episode, before we even get to the high drama of human nature and family of blood, he trapped those witches in a crystal ball and put them in the attic in the TARDIS.
But they're evil. Yes. They're evil.
But we didn't make a big deal about it with the drums and everything. Like, it wasn't the oncoming storm is so terrible and lonely that he put her in a mirror. No, it was like, I'm throwing the attic. It's fine.
Yeah, but I'm talking about the way that the Doctor treats his, even his companions. He was awful to them, including Sarah Jane. Tom Baker just deserts Sarah Jane. She gets her own back in what's the name of the episode with
school
reunion with Giles in it. now Uther Pendragon on Merlin, by the way.
You know, it's interesting. I was listening to
wait a minute. I mean,
we'll get there, Kat. Yeah.
They came out with Doctor Who and the BBC, which is a collection of a bunch of radio snippets and shows that the Doctor has done since the relaunch, and it was edited by Liz Sladen. And they were doing some interviews with Christopher Eccleston, and this was before the series aired, and they were talking to him about, you know, are you a fan? Were you a fan? You know, what do you think the Doctor is all about? And he said, you know, I was watching it, and they were talking about it specifically aimed towards children. And the question was, you know, what do you think kids are going to think about this? And he said, I was watching it with a friend who and their children, and after it was over, the child said, is he a good guy or a bad guy? Mm. And he said, I really like that. I like that ambiguity about the character. And I think that really comes through in the series.
I think it does. I think it comes through more with Chris Eccleston than it does with Tennant. And so what they did was they split the universe, where David Tennant was a nicer, warmer, cuddlier doctor, and then there's
I disagree.
And then there's Torchwood. You want darkness. You want adult. You want snogging.
Well, it's
snogging
it's
anything
even,
in sight. Snogging a Dalek. You watch Torchwood.
Well, it's not even like. I think it's stuff like. When the doctor,
by the way, station break time, WBAI New York. Sorry, go on.
when the doctor ruins Harriet Jones, mm-hmm. like that moment is like, what was that? Why did you feel the need to do that? And it's not as if she did anything that he had never done mm-hmm. recently, but he was all on his high horse about it. Or that Rose had done.
I despised what he did to Harriet Jones. I thought that was awful.
Nor do I think it's narratively supported at all.
At all.
Or
necessary.
No, it was gratuitous. It was absolutely, utterly Joss Whedon gratuitous. It was, whoops, other show.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's things like that that he does. And I particularly get tired of all the times where he's like, I have to give them a chance to turn about and be nice. And when he's not really giving them a chance, because what he's doing is he's some random dude in a suit telling them, hey, stop. And they're like, haha, no, we're not. And he's like, I warned you. And then he, like, unleashes, you know, the fires of Hades.
No higher authority
if you're looking
for one.
Now, how is that fair? Like, he didn't even really explain to them. He didn't sit them down and go, look, I'm the doctor.
I will torch you.
I will torch you. Okay. And then they could be like, hmm.
But, you know, you got that in Christmas Invasion when he walked back. He said, no second chances. I'm that sort of a man. And I think at that point, you know, Christopher Eccleston comes across as very broody and dark and this very tortured soul. But I think David Tennant hides a lot of darkness under quicksilver sort of manic persona.
And a lot of that is in the performance, I must say. So let us continue to go around the room. And I will not say when Catherine M. Valenti is about to speak, don't you think she looks tired?
That ain't right.
That's not nice.
I said I will not say.
So I'm Catherine Valenti. I write fantasy novels. Palimpsest was mentioned as my most recent book.
Orphan's Tales, 1 and 2.
It's not even my most recent book. Under in the Mirror, which is an Arthurian book, is my most recent book.
So that means that you have to come back and do another show.
Okay. Twist my arm.
I just did.
and my essay in the book is called Regeneration X. And it's...
She made Jim spit coffee.
Oh, yay, awesome. Oh, it'll be a good day.
Radio spit takes.
And it's a really personal essay, which is... Nobody ever asks me to write fanish essays. This is the first time I have ever been asked to write about something I'm a dork about. And thank you, Lynn. Yay. I was so excited to do it because I mean, I blather about things on my live journal all the time, but when people ask me to write essays, it's usually about writing craft or about you know, my own books or something like that. Nobody ever asked me to just dork out about a fandom. And I have so many fandoms I dork out about. But Doctor Who is really near and dear to my heart. And, I mean, I think second only to the I Saw Tom Baker on PBS story is the Rose Was My First Episode story. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, Rose Was My First Episode. I think that maybe the first time I ever heard of Doctor Who was in a Buffy episode. I mean, I hate to say that. It's so embarrassing, but it's true. But I was living in Norfolk, Virginia. If there's any natives of Norfolk listening, or Norfolk, I'm sorry, I'm really sorry, but that place sucks. it is, and not only does that place suck, but I am deeply allergic to mold, and it's a fetid swamp.
Ooh.
So I was laid up a lot living down there, and my ex-husband was in the Navy, and I was alone a lot, too. And we didn't have television. We didn't have cable. So you have to make your own fun. And so I was down at the video store, and there was this little blue box, and it was the season one DVD set. And I was like, well, I like Chris Eccleston.
And by the way, may I just say, there are two schools of thought here. Officially, that's season one. For some of us, that's season 28.
I know, but it says season one across the top of the box.
No, and that's how they do it. And what's forthcoming is series 5.
Mm, yeah.
Or, it depends who you talk to. It could be season one point, of the Moffat era.
The BBC...
Stephen Moffat refers to it as season snarg because it's so difficult to quantify which season it actually is.
But this is how the BBC is promoting it, is series 5.
And you know, I knowing so little about Doctor Who walking into that, I mean, just absolutely... Like, when I saw School Reunion, I had no idea who that woman was.
Yeah, most
no
people
idea.
Didn't.
But it's a testament to the writing and the acting that I immediately Googled the name Sarah Jane Smith because it was obvious she was somebody, you know, that she was from the previous... show. I didn't know who K-9 was. I came to it very, very raw.
And may I just say, by the way, that I loved that she got her own back, that she got to say, you left me there, that whole thing where she took that revenge on what happened in the Douglas Adams, Tom Baker era. I thought that was so well done and was, I'm forgetting the name of the writers, Toby Whithouse's finest moment, despite liking being human, which I know I may be alone in this room, but...
I'm still waiting to see it, but I do think it goes in like top 5 hugs in TV history.
Yeah, it's
a great moment.
It is. It's one. I love it. And of course, I'm a Sarah Jane fan.
Right.
She's my favorite companion.
And you know, I would not say Rose is my favorite companion ultimately, but it's a really great entrance point for new fans. She is the point of view character. And I mean, I was not even aware that the Doctor regenerated. That like when he regenerated into David Tennant, I was like, oh,
I was the exact same way.
And then I didn't know that the companions were going to change out too. Mm-hmm. So, but at the end of season 2, I was like, I don't know if I can watch the show anymore because nobody I was initially invested in is on it again. But anyway, to step back to what I was saying, is that I was watching the first season of the new series, and the first couple episodes were cute. I wasn't overly impressed by it, but you know, it was all right. And then I think Dalek was probably the first episode that I started to really get into it. And then,
that's the first one with some gravitas.
Right. Yeah. But I mean, Dr. Dances is the episode where I was in love with
the
that
The Empty Child and the Doctor Dances. Just this. I mean, just this is what everybody loves. That is...
It's so gorgeous.
I think of... the new era Who, and maybe of all of Who, The Empty Child and The Doctor Dances, I think, is the finest moment.
I actually disagree with you.
Ah, what?
But I am going, if I can finish my story, I'll end at the
Please.
Moment I think is the finest moment.
Okay, but let me just tell listeners, I think it's at least a good entry point for those people who say, what are they talking about on
phenomenal.
The radio? Watching those two episodes is a great entry point, and... John Barrowman.
Yes, John Barrowman.
And his sister wrote an essay for the book.
Yay! That's and what's right. that book called again?
What book are you talking about,
Lynn? Time Lords, and it's available from Mad Norwegian Press.
Available where?
And other fine booksellers, especially places like Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Galaxy 4, Mysterious Galaxy, and any of your local independent booksellers.
Like Blue Stockings.
Like Blue Stockings in New York.
Just to choose one at random.
One at random. They may have some signed stock still sitting around for all I know.
Ooh. Hey, by the way, I have to ask everybody in this room, how do I get a copy, huh?
We'll have to bring you one.
Yes, you will.
At some point.
Yes, I was hoping to have one this morning so I could get it autographed. But okay.
You know, I might have a copy.
Okay.
Well, we'll see. But Kat, please continue.
So, at that point,
I'm bribing my guests.
At that point, I think that my addiction changed in a way that possibly nobody else in this room has this story, and it's not in my essay in the book. But there's a site called Television Without Pity, and Television Without Pity is an awesome site. But there is a recapper there named Jacob, and Jacob is a very serious gentleman. And when he recaps a show, he doesn't just recap it, he critiques it. And he goes on long rants about the philosophies of the shows. And I started reading his Doctor Who recaps. And I fell in love with the show in a whole other way because every week there was someone there to tell me what it was really all about and to make it this incredibly deep, critical experience for me. And I'm an academic. I love my incredibly deep critical experiences. And he was talking about what he wanted from the show. And he sees it as this whole Gnostic fable. And I think that's interesting. And great. And when I saw the final episode of season one, or not one, and I saw Rose ascend the way she did, my jaw was on the floor. And whatever we think about Rose later on, I haven't seen a science fiction show even try for what they did with that character.
True.
To make her into literally the Gnostic Sophia goddess. I mean, they absolutely went
the Sophia
mat.
Goddess. I never thought of that, but you're so correct.
Yeah, I mean, they went to the mythological mat there, and I really appreciated it, especially, you know, given that she is kind of a Buffy knockoff, but without any of the powers. So it's sometimes hard for me to really identify with Rose. But seeing her arc like that, it was amazing. And I it was so much more. Even Jacob said, nothing I could have predicted would have been as good as what they did.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sold forever, no matter how many lackluster episodes, and there have been a lot of lackluster
yes,
episodes.
Many, many.
It's that first season that sold me on it.
Yeah.
And so as I've grown through the years watching this...
Eccleston is just amazing.
And Eccleston is amazing. But I ended up writing this essay because the 5 years that the new Doctor Who has been on has been literally the most eventful 5 years of my life. And from where I was five years ago to where I am now is a regeneration. That I regenerated my life. And so when I look at Doctor Who, I see my life story there, and that's what literature's for. You see your life story in it, and it's still.
So, are you then the second cat? with
yeah,
nine,
yeah,
with
I'm
nine
the second cat.
Overall.
Absolutely,
okay, cool.
Absolutely. And so, I wrote this really personal essay about what Doctor Who meant to me on a mythological and psychological basis. Because one of the things that Lynn asked when she emailed me about it was to talk about how I saw the Doctor in my own life, and that's what I talked about in my essay.
Cool.
And I'm really proud of this essay. I actually think it might be my best nonfiction piece.
Wow. That's saying
something,
actually.
So you guys should really buy it because it is... I don't want to be like, oh, I'm so awesome. But I'm really, really proud of it.
Does this mean new tats?
No, but I will say I have...
Radio audiences want to know.
No, not new tattoos. But on my desk is a small object, and it has a story that's very important to me. After I finished watching the first... or not first, season of Doctor Who, I wrote on my live journal, I said, I need a TARDIS. I need a die-cast TARDIS to put on my desk to remind myself that when someone asks me to go on an adventure, to say yes. To say yes to every journey into the unknown and strange and frightening. And when I won the Tiptree Award, my editor, Juliette Ullman, sent me one.
Oh, how wonderful. That is really
And so I have a TARDIS on my desk and always will.
Aww.
Okay, so before we move on, I just have to add to, yes, here we are. So, let's see, what do we want here? Which effect? here we go. That's from the Hartnell era.
I have watched.
Is that one of the war machines?
No, this is labeled TARDIS Takeoff.
Huh.
Believe it or not, obviously interior.
Yeah.
Obviously, but okay. Whoops.
Someone needs to do like meditation trance music with this.
We have here.
Have you listened to Kit Peddler's soundtracks? It's pretty much the same thing.
I haven't actually.
Whoops. There's interior TARDIS sound. And by the way, at some point I'm going to have to do a whole show just about the BBC Radiophonic Workshop and what they did for Doctor Who and what they did for Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. One of the best moments in radio, one of the best places ever to be. There was actually a 90-minute BBC documentary on that and how all the tapes were being gotten rid of, and the BBC in its wisdom just constantly destroying episodes of Doctor Who and other old shows like that, episodes of The Avengers Lost Forever pre-Diana Rigg, the Honor Blackman episodes, and even before Honor Blackman, Dr. Noel, whatever. Let us move on, shall we, and introduce yourself, tell us who you are, and what your current stuff is, and so forth.
All right. Hello, my name is Katie Shuttleworth, and unlike my lovely ladies, I did not write anything for this book, but I drew the book cover, and then I also drew the comic about Torchwood Babies, the webcomic, strategic place in the center of the book.
And let me just say that, you know, when Tempest first mentioned Chicks Dig Time Lords, and I'm going, yes, I have to do the show, and she had mentioned on the show, and I pretended that I knew something about Torchwood Babies, and by the way, that's with a Z on the end.
Yes.
I just went online, and a moment later, Barbara is over my shoulder, and it was a work day, and we just stopped for an hour, and then started sending this to people.
Aww.
Everybody, you have to go online and do Torchwood Babies. It is wonderful.
Thank you.
Having said that, pray continue.
But my experience was watching Rose. I work as an animator as my day job, and one of my coworkers had handed me the first season on DVD and the second season not on DVD to watch, and said, well, you like sci-fi and you like British things, so you should watch this. I was like, yeah, whatever. You know, the only thing I knew about Doctor Who was that there was a dude with a scarf, you know, a billion years ago at some point. And then I watched it, and it the same thing. It wasn't until about, you know, Dalek that I was like, ooh, the show. And then Father's Day, where I, you know, I had to go break out a box of tissues. It was just like, oh,
it's a good one.
This show. Yeah. But yeah, it's kind of like I was saying earlier that it was an interesting concept to me, because like I said, I'm in animation, which has been, you know, forced told me that it's a male dominated field, you know, for however many decades. When I was at art school, it was the exact same thing. You know, I had classes of like 30 students in it, and you know, on average there would be 3 female students. And then I actually got a job when I moved here to New York that it was very female dominated, which was just kind of like, oh, well, that's interesting. They've kind of been lying to me, but you know, whatever. This is awesome.
What animation do you do?
I do flash animation. I'm currently working on a new PBS kids show.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just kind of like an interesting concept. And so when I actually entered Doctor Who fandom, it was through LiveJournal, which is very dominantly female.
Which is a blog, we should tell people.
Yes, it's a
social networking service.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
And it's very, very female dominated. And it wasn't until I actually went to my first Doctor Who convention that I realized, oh, guys actually watch this show? Because all of my experience had been women. So, yeah, that was...
You were lucky.
I know. It's like, oh, okay. But, yeah, I met Tammy online at one point, and she was at Gallifrey One in Los Angeles and saw some girls running around dressed up as the Torchwood characters, and I guess they call themselves the Torchwood Kids. And she's like, "Oh my God, it's the Torchwood Kids! I love the Torchwood Kids!" And somebody commented, "Like, those are two things that should never ever be uttered in the same sentence."
which is sort of the premise of Torchwood Babies, right?
Yes,
there.
Yes, yes.
Two words that should never, you know, yes, go together, right?
And then Tammy brought up to like, "Well, you know." What about Torchwood and babies? So that's kind of like, you know, the wheels start spinning in her head, and she wanted to pitch a animated short, and then said, you know, on Live Journal, said, "Hey, is anybody an artist out there?" And I responded, and then I was like, "Ooh, you know, an animated short. That's what I do for a living." And then I came to my senses because I know exactly how long animation takes to do, and it would probably be a very long time. So I pitched the idea of doing a comic, and, you know, we originally wrote the script for something that was supposed to be, you know, a single, you know, comic that was probably going to be about 10 pages, and now it's, like, almost up to 40, and we're still not done.
Yeah, then there's a promise for the next episode being about last December, as I recall.
Yeah, well...
Barbara and I were...
Yeah.
I know.
Unfortunately,
reality has to
you're not getting and
yeah. Live Journal doesn't pay a whole lot.
It's like this radio show.
Yeah,
I'm doing it for the love, but yeah.
Yeah, but the love is there. I'm telling everybody.
but the love does not pay my bills.
Yeah, but we have to find a way to get you a better Earl. I mean, Live Journal is fine, but there has to be a way for people to easily find that, because it took me
torturedbabies.com
is yeah
.org.
Yeah.
But
let's not talk about it. Yeah.
Look, Katie, you have to mention that it's Torture Babies is now canon.
Yes. So having gone to, you know, a couple of the conventions, we've kind of discovered that, you know, the people who actually work on Doctor Who have read our comic, which is, you know, just mind-blowing in itself. That we've found out.
Bearing in mind that they came out of fandom, I mean, a lot of what propelled them was listening to Big Finish, is how the Time Wars got into the canon, which never should have been.
No, it's yeah, it was, you know, like, we found out that John Barrowman has a printed version of his baby self up in his office or what have you.
I'll just bet he does. I can imagine.
And then Tammy and I became friends with Tony Lee, who's the head writer for the Doctor Who IDW ongoing comic. And there is a shout out to Torchwood Babies in the most recent issue, number 9, that, you know, to the casual reader, it will most certainly, you know, fly over their heads. But to me and Tammy, mm-hmm. you know, it means something. So it was just kind of like, you know, it's very surreal that, you know, we're fans and then they're fans of us, and
that's how you got in, and now you're part of the fold.
Yeah, it's kind of weird.
And it's a multidimensional fold, so yes. It sort of all works.
It's bigger on the inside.
It is bigger on the inside.
Yes, indeed.
And I have to say, like, when I found out that Katie was doing something for this book, I was like, I am in. Torchwood Babies is the best thing I have ever seen. And I think that probably there are very few webcomics that I follow, but Torchwood Babies is one of them. And one of my other favorites is called The Ten Doctors.
Yes.
And I love The Ten Doctors, and I'm so sad that they're not being colored in, but I can deal with pencil. but that's another comic.
No, you print it out and you get your crayons.
That's right, you get your crayons, and you just fill that in. But The Ten Doctors is one of those things where,
you know, you can't have this on television, so you have it on paper in comic form, and it's really wonderful. And Torchwood Baby is the same way. It's like, we can't have that on television. But yeah. In the absence of being able to have it on television, little Jack walking around with this little coat.
Oh, God.
It cracks me up every time. So.
The coats. And the 10th Doctor's coat is also just sort of
they're all dragging on
the glasses. It's the glasses, let me just say. I mean, these caricatures are just wonderful. The whole thing is really good. And the writing is good.
Yes.
It's one thing to just have this wonderful little conceit and all that, but to make it consistently good and readable, and oh my God, I want more.
Oh, thank you.
You know, and it accomplishes all that. It's one thing to go, oh, that's a clever idea, that's nice Spanish stuff, and there's another thing to go, wow, this is, you know, this is where it's at. Better than homage.
Yeah, the one thing we talked about last night, you were saying, I became friends with Tony Lee, and I think more so than any other fandom, that Doctor Who is, it's being made by us. You know, the people that are making Doctor Who were who we are back in the 70s and 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. And it's a very accessible sort of TV show. I mean, the writers and the creators, and they blog and they tweet, and that doesn't always work out if you want to talk to James Moran. but they're very accessible. I mean, you can go to a con and you can talk to Paul Cornell, or you can talk to Gary Russell, and it's, I find that very different from American fandom, where there's always kind of that layer in between the creators and the fans. We're in Doctor Who, we're all part of this kind
blur.
Of, the lines blur, and like we're all, you know, we're all fans, ultimately.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that depends, I mean, on different people's experiences. I mean, I have the great fortune of being able to sit in this seat and invite writers on, and so I meet people like, you know, Kat Bondi and Tempest Bradford and all that, and those.
We're totally inaccessible. I'm in, like castle.
But you see, that's exactly my point. My point is that I can have you here. You are here. And I've had, if I can boast for a second, Clifford Simak and Alfred Bester and all these people have also been in this room. Mm. So there is, and these are, you know, fabulous people. Look, when, you know, and we get those people to the various readings that are either at the KGB Fantastic Fiction Series or at the one I produce, the New York Review of Science Fiction Series. So even if you're not in fandom, I find that a lot of these folk are real and are accessible. And that is the joy of fandom. Mm-hmm. And these people, you see, I'm not in Doctor Who fandom. I've never actually been to a WhoCon. So to me, the names Paul Cornell and all these people are, in fact, on the other side of the glass tube. Mm-hmm. So it all depends, and this is important to tell listeners, it all depends on what you make it. And I must say, especially for those people who are aspiring writers who want to be, you know, who want to be that, go to a good convention, go to these readings, become a part of this. I personally recommend one that Tempest didn't like last year, but I'm a big fan of ReaderCon.
I like ReaderCon.
No, you.
I think you're talking about me, actually.
WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM.
Oh, I was the one who said don't swear online in the car, too. Online, on the radio. It's way too early.
I have news for you. It didn't happen.
All right, there we go.
I pressed the TARDIS button over here, yay! And I am the seven-second delay time lord.
All right.
who starts scandals online? It was I.
And we're out of safe harbor, what they call in England watershed.
Who stirred things up online about ReaderCon. I like ReaderCon quite a bit. The scandal was not about that at all.
Oh, that that was something else. That
was plans for this year, which have completely changed now.
Well, yes. Thank God. No. That was. I mean, I wasn't only on your side there. I was leading. I even did a whole thing on the air about.
Oh wow!
That.
Yeah.
I was virulent about that whole thing, and yeah, I was ready to attend your convention this year. But it's back.
It is back. I would suggest WISCON, actually. I think WISCON is an amazing.
WISCON specifically is a feminist convention. It's an open. And to me, feminist means open to all.
It is very much so.
Yeah,
and
you know,
there are plenty of panels that are about Doctor Who and are about Buffy and all kinds
I'm
of media.
I'm often on them.
Yes.
My problem with WISCON is it's in Wisconsin.
I know. And actually, you know, it's become a problem for me as well because I used to live in Ohio and it was a drive and now I live in Maine.
And it's
a whole different situation.
So for those listeners who have access.
So WISCON is worth it.
Yeah. It's worth it. I go every year, and Madison's a cool town, and I love it. And actually, that was how Lynn and I met.
That's how Lynn and I met, too.
Yeah, because I was on a panel. I had suggested a panel about Martha Jones for WISCON, and I was on the panel, but I wasn't the moderator, and that was the first mistake. And and then, like, I can't remember the name of the panel moderator, but he was a guy who...
It was my husband.
Oh, okay. So, wait, your husband was a moderator? Okay. Anyway, so...
Yeah,
it was,
Michael. That was my husband. Oh, okay. He was the moderator of the panel.
So Michael was moderating the panel. I'm actually supposed to be the moderator of the Who panel at LunaCon today.
Oh.
But I'm not going to make it because I'm really under the weather.
Oh.
It was either him or Chris Hill. Those are the two guys that were on the panel.
Yeah, it was... Well, and Chris wasn't the moderator, so it was definitely Michael.
Yeah.
And I think, like, there was some miscommunication about what was supposed to go on at that panel because I wanted to talk about Martha Jones and race, and other people were talking about some other stuff. And so I was like, no, Martha Jones and race, why can't we talk about that more? So then Lynn was like, hey, you want to write this essay about Martha Jones and race? I was like, yes. Let me write now. Give it to me now. So yeah, that's how we met. And we're doing a Chicks Dig Time Lords thing at WISCON this year.
Cool.
Yeah.
And there's
also going to be a signing, actually, before WISCON, April 25th at a Room of One's Own bookstore in Madison, Wisconsin, which is a feminist bookstore in Madison.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be myself and Tara O'Shea and Carol Barrowman, John's sister.
Ooh.
Who's also the co-author of his autobiographies. She has an essay in the book where she talks about the fact that he's still afraid of shop window dummies.
Yep, see.
And she's going to be there for the signing.
That's way cool. Okay.
Yeah. So check out our Facebook page for events.
Yes.
Okay. So now we need to...
Chick Time Lords. Generation Trev.
Available.
Available at fine booksellers everywhere.
Thank you very much. Okay. So I'll reset the timer. So so we've named now an East Coast Good Con, a Midwest Good Con, and is there anything on the equivalent on the West Coast, or should we just forget those
there's
people?
Plenty of Good Cons on the West. There's Norwest Con, there's WesterCon, there's a lot.
There's Potlatch.
Okay.
There's Emerald City Comic Con. Emerald City Comic Con is great.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there is the Comic Con, but I mean, I find that incredibly overwhelming.
That's a circus,
But there's a lot of good West
Coast. What I'm trying to talk about is I'm trying to further to listeners, you know, saying you can be a part of this world where those layers go.
And there's this little thing called Gallifrey One that comes out every year, which I think is in the 22nd year. And that's, how many people were there this year? Over 1,500?
1,500. It's the biggest Doctor Who convention in the country. The other one that happens every year is Chicago TARDIS, which is my home convention because I live outside of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Thanksgiving weekend, and then Gallifrey One tends to be in February.
And actually, the people that run Chicago TARDIS were going to do New York TARDIS this year in May, and they decided to hold off a year so they could get it together. And that's an incredibly well-run convention.
Oh, good.
I've never been there.
Because I was going to say, there's nothing here. There really isn't anything
But it looks like in 2011, there's going to be the New York TARDIS, which will be the Chicago TARDIS equivalent.
Awesome.
Cool.
I'll be there.
Next question, or actually, in a way, first question, because we've just been doing introductory and sidebars. Dare we ask, Easter Day, Easter Day this year, I have trepidations. I do. I trust, I like the writing of Stephen Moffat a whole lot, if only for The Empty Child and The Doctor Dances and Professor Riversong and Blink. Blink is just an amazing episode. And yes, Carey Mulligan nominated for an Academy Award. I called it when I saw Blink. I saw her there and I said, this is going to be a great actress. And here she was for an Academy Award this year. But so I like Moffat's writing to a large extent of what he's done. I see problems. But when I saw the casting of the next Doctor and when I've seen the BBC promos for the launch in Easter, have you all seen it?
The promos are really terrible.
I mean, promo monkeys are notoriously awful.
But they weren't as bad. I mean, if you watch the promos for, and especially by the way, this year's Christmas trailers for David Tennant, those were wonderful.
But then the Christmas special was terrible, so maybe this time.
I'm talking about. Good point.
You know. Remember, we love the show.
But I refuse to admit that any of the Christmas specials exist, except the one where Tennant is adjusting to his new regeneration.
That was the best one.
The Christmas Invasion.
But that's still the Harriet Jones thing.
I thought it was a quality episode with a very strange.
It was. But I had so much hope for the one called The Next Doctor just because David Morrissey. Yeah. And by the way,
I really enjoyed The Next Doctor, but I think they missed out on not turning the TARDIS into a giant mecha.
Yeah, that's a good thought.
I really had giant fighting robots, and that would have been awesome.
Yeah. I liked The Next Doctor until the last 20 minutes, and then it just fell apart. It just fell apart, but it was a good thought.
It's like a Torchwood episode.
If you didn't do that, it wouldn't be Torchwood.
Yeah, well, I mean, just Torchwood always does that. It falls apart in the last, like, 10, 15 minutes. You're like, wait a minute, now this episode was going along quite fine, and suddenly Jack is giving people pills and making them forget.
Yeah, yeah. I hate the Superman kiss. I despise Lois will never remember.
But that was actually a superpower that Superman had, which made it even worse. That was canon. Yeah. You're like, no.
Although I did like Children of Earth.
People are making in their pint.
Well, Children of Earth is one of the few times when like a really good Torchwood episode doesn't fall apart at the end. I think the only other one that I can remember off the top of my head, and I can't remember the name of it, but it was the first one where Martha shows up on Torchwood,
Rehab? No.
Or is it Dead Man Walking?
That was the second one. That was the second one. Yeah.
So it's Rehab. So Katie must be right. Yeah.
So it was that one and. And I remember, actually, when I had that episode, I watched, like, maybe 35 minutes of it, and then I, like, stopped because it was going so well. And I was afraid. I was like, oh, my God, they're going to ruin it. They're going to ruin it at the last minute. I'm going to be so sad because I love Martha. But, actually, that episode was, like, all the way until the end, awesome. And then at the end, they shot Owen, and I was like, oh, my God, yes. That was the best episode ever.
But didn't you hate that they actually took Martha out of the action by making her an old woman? It's like they removed.
Well, that was the next episode.
Like, right. Three-story arc.
Right. But no, that's like individually that one episode is like the best episode of Torchwood ever because Martha is there. She's awesome all the way through.
It is
story.
A good one until they shoot Owen.
No. Owen, that was like the cherry on top of my sundae.
Oh, okay.
I am alone in this room with my Owen appreciation.
No, you're not.
Thank you, Lynn. I know I liked you.
No, and I liked Owen in the actor in Bleak House, but anyway.
Bert Gorman is a great actor. I actually just find Owen fascinating. I don't think he's likable, but
absolutely
I think
not.
Different.
Oh, he's dark. He's not likable. He's nasty SOB.
And season one Owen is much more interesting than season two Owen. I don't know what happened during hiatus, but he came back.
A lot of things happened during hiatus.
Came back wrong. But back to the whole Matt Smith thing.
You said the word.
Matt Smith. Hey, okay, so here's the thing. There was a moment for me when my doctor broke apart and this guy with spiky hair who looked like a rat and had a huge nose came spawning out of him. And I was like, who is this guy? I don't know if I can keep going. And if I can get used to David Tennant and learn to love him, I am sure that I will learn to love Matt Smith and his floppy hair and his bow tie.
We will see. I mean, he's a good actor.
But isn't this what we do? Isn't this like church for us to have trepidation about the new doctor and wish that our doctor could go on forever? I mean, this is what Doctor Who fans do. I don't think that the Doctor Who is going to come to an end on Matt Smith's watch. And if it does, they'll fire him and there'll be a new one.
And Neil Gaiman said, it's tradition. You hate the new doctor for the first 2 weeks and then you love him because that's what we do.
Yeah, right, that may very well be. What I'm concerned about, where I am concerned, is as much as I like a lot of the writing of Stephen Moffat, and by the way, let us mention Jekyll.
Right. Love Jekyll. You know, I was watching that and going, why does this seem so much like Doctor Who? Like, what is going on with this? Because I wasn't paying attention. I'm not a credits watcher. So it took about 6 episodes before I was like, oh, I see Moffat's name. No wonder this feels like a Who episode somehow.
But you see, one of my problems is I had different candidates for the next Doctor.
Patterson Joseph.
No.
That's who I wanted.
He is a brilliant one. I use the B word. He is a wonderful, great, excellent actor, from his James Bond appearances to his various Shakespearean kind of stuff. But I will say, and I don't think you ever looked him up, Adrian Lester.
Adrian Lester, actually, I also thought was a very strong candidate.
I think Adrian Lester had the chops. He's not a little kid. He is...
You know, why do we gotta bash the young people? Seriously? Like, they... Because they will
be Torchwood babies next?
Oh, good Lord, he's my age. I mean, come on.
Well... Look at me.
Older than me. You don't call me a baby when I'm on the show. No. That's been a baby.
No.
You know, I wasn't too upset about whoever they would put on the role, because I think, you know, for me, it's not so much an actor driven thing, it's a writer driven thing. Mm-hmm. And I do, Stephen Moffat is,
yes,
right, you know, Stephen Moffat.
I'm sorry, Lynn?
Stephen Moffat.
I was saying Tom Baker used to say that the role was actor proof.
Mm, yeah. Right, mm-hmm. Right.
And he's proof. I'm sorry.
Stephen Moffat is dodgy in interviews. I'll give him that. And I don't like some of the things that he has done. But I think it was time for a new story. I think Russell started out, and I love Russell, and I love the Doctor, and I love Rose, and I love all his characters. But he really kind of boxed that story in with the love story of the Doctor. And
yes,
Rose.
I agree.
And there was no place for the 10th Doctor to go, you know, without coming off as being the emo jerk.
No, right. I agree, and I think that a 3-year span is perfect for every doctor, right, Chris Eccleston? But and what have you done with your career?
He was Destro.
He
was on Heroes too.
Yeah, he was on 2 episodes of Heroes. He got 3 minutes of screen time all
he's
told.
He's coming back.
As Claude Rains, he is.
He is. I heard he was going to be back.
Yeah, no, I gave up on
a little
Heroes.
Bit more back. Time.
I did too, but I heard that Claude was coming back. Yeah.
No, Claude is coming back. I'm there.
Claude's been gone for like 3 seasons. I mean,
No. He's been there the whole time. He's just invisible.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Like they pay like Chris Eccleston just to pretend.
He's there.
Yeah. Well, so I definitely agree that the time of Russell T. Davies was good to end it.
Yeah.
And I also like,
and it's also a tradition with the script editors, right, like Douglas Adams. Yeah. It's time to move on.
Right. And I knew, like, there was never any doubt in my mind that when Russell T. Davies left, they were going to give it to Stephen Moffat, because I am a longtime Coupling fan, and Coupling was Stephen's show that he did before Doctor Who, and it was like his show, and Coupling was filled
the British version.
The British version, and Coupling was filled with Doctor Who references. Like, he was like the biggest, most public Doctor Who nerdy fan, like on the TV for a very long time. So, you know, it was no surprise when they brought the show back that he was going to write some episodes, and it is no surprise that that he's become a very popular Doctor Who writer and that he was going to take over. But I am nervous, because Stephen Moffat, like, not only does he say sketchy things in interviews about women and relationships, but like he puts sketchy things in his scripts, and you know, it's not always apparent upon first watch I keep saying that I've watched like all of the episodes of Coupling about 50 times, and it took like it took me until 50 to realize some of like the really shady things that were going on in Coupling.
I think the relations of women in Jekyll are very interesting.
Yeah, and it's
I had a lot of problems.
Yeah, with and exactly, Jekyll. and it's like sometimes it's more apparent than others. I think that one of the reasons why it's not as apparent in Coupling is because Coupling is a comedy, and so you know, and Stephen is a great writer. Like there's no doubt about that. Like he is a good writer. He's good with plot. He's good with character, and he's good with that snappy dialogue. Like, and so a lot of the problems with Coupling are hidden by like the great snappy dialogue and the really funny situations that are going on. But like I said, after you watch it about 50 times, you start to think deeper about it, and then you become a sad person because you've watched Coupling 50 times.
But it's interesting because even if you don't watch it 50 times, nevertheless, what you're talking about, Tempest, is still something that's going to go into people's subconscious.
Right.
It's something that they will experience, and even if they don't analyze it the way that you did, they experienced it, and the pollinization, whatever, that comes out of that becomes a part of our persona. So what I may not see that you're talking about, sometimes, you know, I'll read something that you write or Kat writes or something like that, or the essays in
Extinct Time Lords, published by Mad Norwegian Press, available at fine booksellers everywhere.
Awesome.
If you and if you were to read one of those essays, if I read one of those essays, I all of a sudden go, I didn't know that, but I knew that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like
you
recognize and, it. And yet, I think this is true of Joss Whedon as well.
Like, oh, mm-hmm. Definitely.
And yet, he gets a pass as a feminist, and people wouldn't be nervous
not
if Joss
Whedon.
Well, but nobody gets a pass from you, Tempest.
No, he gets a pass for empowering women, but not as a feminist.
Well, he only empowers them to kill them.
Well, yeah. I mean,
well, let's
not get into things Joss Whedon does wrong. But if Joss Whedon were taking over Doctor Who, I don't think there would very many people who are not Tempest would be having trepidation about how he was going to treat women. I mean, I think people get passes, especially male writers, get passes for this kind of stuff all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yet Moffat is, in certain circles of fandom, not getting even, you know, the rope to hang himself with.
I think that's just because it's got a lot to do with the fact that whenever a new season happens, we're all like, when is the Moffat episode coming? And then when the Moffat episode comes, people are like, that was the greatest episode ever. Even if it wasn't, people are like, oh, the Moffat episode. And this has like become like a thing. Like, the Moffat episode.
Surrounded by Davies episodes. Well,
no. Like, that, there's actually not usually that many Davies episodes.
I was really surprised that after the Moffat episode, the Silence in the Library,
which they just rebroadcast.
I want to call it an arc, but it's only two episodes, came midnight,
which was the best.
Amazing episode. It was so good.
And see, that was the thing,
politically so sharp.
Yeah. I mean, there were, like, you know, a lot of the sort of weird, shady episodes that were going on a lot, like, they weren't all Russell T. Davies. Like, there were some of the other writers, too, and you're just like, the Doctor's Daughter.
But you have to remember that while that may not be a Davies episode, it's a Davies season. He's the head writer, and they do something on Doctor Who that they need to learn to do on other series, is they have story conferences.
Right.
They get together and they map the bleeper out from the beginning to the end of the thing so they know where they're going. And obviously, Julie Gardner has to take some credit and blame as well.
But you know what? Give the Doctor's Daughter her due. She gets the ending Donna should have had.
This is true. She does
and
get
she
that.
She gets to fly off. But in the ship at the end.
Superman kiss. I despise.
God. It's my least favorite trope.
And
in
let me let me tell you something. Having rewatched recently the the Silence in the Library episode where Donna lives an entire life. She does the Picard thing, and she meets that wonderful man with a stammer. And then just before
it's so cheap.
And he sees her the anger that I felt for him.
Yeah.
Right.
For him being cheated out of this affair. Why? When they were wrapping up David Tennant, when they let, you know, Barrowman team up with the werewolf, when they which is a wonderful moment.
Yeah.
And when they tie the loose ends, why do they marry Donna off to some other person that she, like the one she was going to marry? Why didn't they bring him in?
Why did
from
they,
the Silence
why
of the
did
Library?
They even bring Catherine Tate back if they weren't going to redeem that terrible story story that took her mind away.
Yeah.
Why did they bring her back?
Right.
Well, you know, he slipped a tenner on the nightstand when he was done with her.
God. Like, I mean, I really did feel like it was a slap in the face. That like you were talking about, this fandom is very self-aware, and the creators know that we didn't like that plot line.
Yeah.
And they brought her back and waved her in our face and took it away.
Yeah. Well, everything about that last episode was a slap in the face to all Doctor Who fandom.
We love the show.
We love the show. And that's what makes
that's
it
why
so
we have
hard.
High expectations for it.
That's what makes it so hard, is that you love the show and you love these characters, and you see these things like the Waters of Mars, and you're like, what?
I'm really? Not angry, I'm just disappointed.
Right. I liked Waters of Mars. I enjoyed Waters of Mars. I may be the only one here, but I you know, you were talking about, you know, they're being showrunners and having these story meetings. And I think
that's
part
the
of
the showrunner.
I think part of, and they do have that in the States. And I think it's a little bit stronger in the States, actually.
Depends on the show.
Well, true.
Really?
But
really?
I feel that, and I said this last night, particularly with the Moffat episodes, that Russell pretty much gave Stephen Moffat carte blanche to write. And he would be gleeful about what Stephen Moffat came up with, rather than saying, you know, really, you're going to marry the Doctor off? He's like, I can't believe Moffat just married the Doctor off to River Song. It's like, okay, I don't have to touch your script. Whatever you give me is going to be perfect. Whether it fits into the continuity smoothly, whether it takes us off on a new tangent, that doesn't matter. It's Stephen Moffat. I love your writing. What do you have for me?
Yeah, but I have to say one thing about River Song, which is another great Moffat creation. I mean, the Jack Harkness and River Song. But
she's not really a Stephen Moffat creation, because she's based on Bernice Summerfield, who was created by Paul Cornell.
I didn't
played
realize.
Played by Lisa Bowerman in the Big Finish audios. And Lisa Bowerman has an essay in Chick-a-Dick Time Lord.
Published by
Mad Norwegian Press, available at fine booksellers everywhere.
Thank you. Because we're nearing the end of the show, and we have to, you know, mention that a couple more times. I had my own personal theory, which is mine, and which about Professor River Song.
Okay.
She's the 19th Doctor.
Okay.
I like that better than the Doctor's wife.
We had a
stairwell conversation.
I wish that they had gone that way. That she turns out that she, I mean, they have doctors meet themselves all the time, collaborate with themselves all the time. Mm-hmm. It's obvious that sooner or later the Doctor is going to himself or, you know, and meet himself.
Have a TARDIS crash or a Titanic crash into the TARDIS.
Exactly. Or whatever. There's the three Doctors, the five Doctors, the two Doctors. They've done all that except in current era, except for time crash.
Right.
My theory, or my preferred thing, is that, you know, what does River Song know? Why does she know the name? Because she's the Doctor. She's a future Doctor.
That would have made it better.
And I also like the theory going around that Donna is the Doctor's mother.
Okay. Oh, I've not heard that one.
Oh, yes. This is a very common fan theory, because the crying woman in... What was the name of the final episode? I can't remember.
The End of Time.
The End of Time. That the crying woman has been confirmed to have been the Doctor's mother, by various writers and actors. And because we're all casting around for some reason for Donna to have been in that episode at all, when Wilf asks the Doctor who was that woman, he looks directly at Donna. Mm. And then he looks back to Wilf. Now, some people say, well, he's drawing a, you know, comparison between the relationship between Wilf and Donna. But a very popular fan theory is that somehow Donna regenerates and becomes the Doctor's mother.
Interesting.
Mm. And I love that theory. And as far as I'm concerned, it is the truth.
There
it's my
goes.
Personal
because
canon,
you know what?
As far as I'm concerned, River Song is the 19th Doctor. I'll take that too.
Because
that's my contribution.
It's like, I even though I have my issues with Stephen Moffat, and even though I realize why so many fans like have this aversion to River Song, actually I liked her. I had no real problem with her.
I'm ambivalent. I really do.
She was
go
the best damn thing on ER too.
Well, there's that. I like Alex Kingston, but I definitely feel like.
And Moll Flanders, she did a great Moll Flanders.
That's true. She did a great Moll Flanders, and I liked River Song, but I also love the idea of Donna becoming the mother of the Doctor. That's so awesome.
These are not incompatible.
They are not at all. Like I'm all.
And then I just want
this.
A whole series of adventures with Donna and River Song as Donna and the Doctor. That
Ooh,
would be
there's
amazing.
A there's
that
a
that would be so awesome.
Yeah,
I agree, because you know what There are times when fan fiction and fan ideas are often better than what we see on television, which is why like the Doctor's Daughter. One of the reasons why that episode upset me so much is I was like, I have read a lot of Mary Sue fan fiction about how the Doctor gets a daughter, and all of it is better than this.
Yes, although you have to admit that Georgina Moffat was just cool.
She was cool, but that whole plot was stupid.
And the idea, by the way, when we talk about the Doctor's Daughter, people have to get the wonderful symmetry. Her name is Moffat. She's not related to Stephen Moffat. It's a different spelling. She is related to the Fifth Doctor. She is the Doctor's Daughter. She's Peter Davison's daughter. I just love that symmetry.
Yes.
But unfortunately, even though that is a wonderful symmetry, it results in yet another little blonde superwoman on Doctor Who.
Right. And I have to say again, she stepped, like, you know, when she was created and she steps out of the, like, thingy that created her, a lot of makeup on.
Mascara and roots.
Oh, it's like, yeah.
That's no more in congruence than the fact that John Barrowman was buried for 1,000 years and that coat regenerated.
Yes, Doctor Who loves it.
Pretty saves all.
And when you talk about gratuitous deaths, the face of Bo, but...
Oh, I liked that.
I liked the death of the face of Bo.
I didn't like the face of Bo.
Love him.
I like Bo, but the throwaway that Jack is the face of Bo. What bothered me about that is because you always get this moaning about, you know, the curse of the Time Lords. I have to live on while everyone else dies. Mm-hmm. The fact that the Doctor would take that moment and kind of chuckle it off, he should react in horror that Jack is now consigned to a fate that's even worse than his.
Right.
And he treats it like this big joke, like a face of Bo.
Well, he's an alien.
That came so far out of left field because if anybody should know how horrible that is, it should be the Doctor, and yet it was a cheap gag.
I don't know, but I feel like the face of Bo had a connection to the world that the Doctor never had. I mean, we know that the face of Bo had kids. I mean,
at least one set, wasn't
he pregnant?
I feel like the face of Bo was living in the world in a way that the Doctor wasn't, and so I don't think it's a horrible fate. I think it's a beautiful ending, and if I'd never watched Torchwood, I would have been happy with that as a send off for Jack. Okay.
We have 2 minutes left on the air.
Oh my goodness.
Can you imagine? Because we have to do outro music and stuff like that. So what we need to do, this time we will end with Lynn, but we're going to again go around the room. Why don't we go counterclockwise, as it were, and then go with Lynn. So Katie?
Yes.
Torchwood Babies. Start with promote what it is. Torchwood Babies and the cover of a book that Lynn's going to mention in a moment. Dick's Time Lords, Volume 1.
I drew a comic for Chick's Dig Time Lords about Torchwood Babies, the web comic that you can find at tw-babiez. .livejournal.com. And yes, I also drew the cover for Chick's Dig Time Lords.
And
Katie, what's her name?
What?
What's the name?
The girl on the cover is named Verity after
Verity Lambert.
Yes.
Yep.
Excellent. And okay.
And when we went to Chicago TARDIS last year, someone cosplayed as her. So that was very surreal.
Okay.
With two iconic pieces of knitwear.
Yes.
90 seconds left, Sorry. Kat.
I'm not entirely sure what I'm supposed to... Am I supposed to promote
Your name is Catherine, Catherine M. Valenti. Your latest book is entitled...
Under in the Mirror.
Still in print, The Orphan's Tales and Palimpsest.
Yes. And
get the map.
Yeah, exactly. Get the map. And I wrote Regeneration X in Chick's Dig Time Lords. And I have a live journal at yukiona.livejournal.com and many, many more books coming out. A ridiculous number, actually.
Cool.
Awesome.
K. Tempest Bradford, what is your name?
My name is K. Tempest Bradford, and you can find me at ktempestbradford.com. I don't have anything coming out at the moment except for this lovely book called Chick's Dig Time Lords. But
you have tons of short stories in print.
Tons of short stories, which you can find on my blog.
Excellent.
My name is Deborah Stanish, and I have an essay, My Fandom Regenerates, and I also have an essay coming out in the next volume of Time Unincorporated, Volume 2, which will be out on May 18th, Lynn?
Yes, May that's 8th. Right.
Okay, Lynn, we have 20 seconds.
I'm Lynn Thomas. I'm the co-editor of Chick Seek Time Lords, and I also have an essay inside called Marrying into the TARDIS Tribe. It's all about being part of fandom as a woman. It's a great book available through Mad Norwegian Press and fine booksellers everywhere.
Yeah, I'm going to have to find that as well. I can't thank you enough. I wish we had another hour at least because we didn't get into doctors, companions, all kinds of stuff. But this was wonderful. We will do it again, and we are going to have a live event 13 weeks after the new season starts. Is that right, Tempest?
That's right.
Okay, very good. And I don't know if we can get people from Indiana or wherever, but we will do what we can to make that a true event because we have time to plan it. Thank you all for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. The book at hand, Chicks Dig at Time Lords. And Mad Norwegian Press once more. And next week on this show, I'm not sure what it will be. Probably a tribute to the late William Tenn. But I also have a couple of shows in the can and recordings and things like that. So tune in and find out. Stay tuned with As I Please with Simon Lokely. And in the meantime, thanks for listening. Have a wonderful day. Get your TARDIS on.
And you are tuned to WBAI in New York City, 99.5 on your FM dial. And good morning and welcome aboard and welcome to As I Please for this, the 20th day of March in the year 10. That's right. Well, you know, in the discussion of management models, Pacifica is often held up as an example of just sheer incompetence with a lot of good intentions. But when it comes to just the grand scale of incompetence, does anything quite match those boys and girls in Albany? Yes, the elected representatives of New York State. And I guess the reason why it's such a problem getting things done in Albany is that no one really wants to be in Albany. Oh, come on, guys, get it together. Now, it is apparently an election year, and might not be a bad idea if we made a solemn vow to turn them all out of office until they agree to get to work. Yeah, there's a thought. Speaking of getting to work, this just in. A front page story in the New York Times this week, and it is beginning to filter into other sources as well, about, well, the headline of the Times, the headline of the Times says it all. Cabbies gouged over $8 million from passengers. Over $8 million, gouging. I love the term gouging. Oh, they're gouging, price gouging. In any case, apparently there is a little switch on the meter, which would add $4 to $5 per ride. And there is one lucky hack of New York City, and I think he deserves to have his name on the air, Wasim Khalid Chima, who overcharged 574 passengers in just 1 month last year. So it does go to show you that there are always inventive ways, you know. A while back, there were a bunch of ticket sellers for a tour bus company who found a way to, well, secrete funds so that you would think you were buying a $44 ticket, but 20 of those dollars went right into the pocket of the ticket agent. Boy, when that was discovered, all heck broke loose. So it just goes to show you that the human mind is an inventive thing. And if it is possible to find a way to cheat, by gum, humans will do it. And so this morning I will break from the odd tradition of As I Please. I begin with something by Basie, but this, a tune appropriate for this story. Taxi War Dance. Thank you. Taxi War Dance, a tune I believe composed by the great Lester Young, and it was the great Prez himself on tenor saxophone with the Count Basie Orchestra. And I do hope that over the course of years that we have spent together, that you may actually now begin to have a sense of familiarity with the music that I play, which is always the same, but I'm thinking in terms of being able to recognize Lester Young, at 20 paces, as it were. And so to continue your sharpening your ears, we turn to the tune that has been my intro theme for many, many years now, and which features on tenor sax the other tenor saxophonist of the Count Basie Orchestra of that time, the great Herschel Evans. So, good morning. Welcome aboard. If you haven't heard yet, you will undoubtedly hear soon enough, not only from me, but for everyone who follows me,